Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books in History podcast, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Christoph Odinets, and today my guest is Dr. Paolo Astori. He is a research associate. He was a research associate at the Catholic University of Leuven Faculty of Law, where he also completed his PhD in 2018. Today, he is a postdoc at the Center of Privacy Studies at the University of Copenhagen. His doctoral dissertation was Lutheran Theology and Contract Law in Early Modern Germany, circa 1520 to 1720, and it investigates the impact of the Lutheran Reformation of the field on the field of contract law. That dissertation is the foundation of the book we are discussing today. Previously, Dr. Astori studied law at the University of Macerata and canon law at the Pontifical Lateran University in Rome. He also worked as a legal apprentice at the Studio Legale Astori in Fermo for 5 years before that. Paolo Astori, welcome to New Books in History, and congratulations on this publication.
Thank you so much. It's a great joy to be here with you. Thank you so much.
Before it was a published monograph, this book was your doctoral dissertation, and one can tell it was. It is very specific and precise. It has a bibliography of 72 pages, and yet it is written in a very accessible and inviting tone. When I read it, I feel that I am in the tall grass of experts, but I never feel lost, which I think is hard to do and quite an achievement. So would you please tell us briefly, what is the scope and aim of this monograph? And can you explain your thesis and walk us through the four parts? Summarize it for us as we begin.
Thank you so much. Yes, of course. I'm very pleased to answer this question. So my book is actually, my PhD is divided in four parts. And the main thesis is actually that there was a Lutheran analysis of contract law. Legal historians are actually familiar with the contribution of the scholastics, the late scholastics, and also the contribution of the medieval canonists. There are books, several books written by legal historians. One was written by my promoter, actually, Wim de Kock, and it was about the contract law of the late scholastics. But nothing about contract law by the Lutherans has been written yet. And so in recent times, there are actually excellent books about the impact of the Reformation on law in general, like the books of Berman or the books of Schmerkel, Witte, and so on. But nothing has been written in specific on contract law. And so my question was, was that possible that the scholastics, the Catholics, discussed contract law issues and not the Lutherans, not the Protestants? Because contract law at the time was very much important for the daily life of Christians. And so Christians had to be guided into the many issues, the many tricky issues of contract law. There was a need of a moral and legal regulation of contracts. And so this is my somehow basic assumption, that existed a Lutheran doctrine of contract, but nobody has ever investigated. And the book is divided in four parts. The first part is about the general. So I explain how and why actually Catholics and Lutherans were dealing with the issues of contract law. Because if we think about the reality of today, nowadays, contract law is very far from theology. So people might think, why are we actually dealing with theologians? Well, theologians were actually involved with contract law, both in the Middle Ages and in the early modern period, and both Catholics and Lutherans. And so I explain this first part, somehow the genre, both from the Catholic and the Protestant side. For the Lutheran side, it's actually an explanation of my sources. Then in the second part, I go on the basic elements. So I explain what are the basic principles of contract law designed by the Lutherans and where we can actually find them. They are included in the seventh commandment, which means you shall not steal, and in the eighth commandment, you shall not bear false witness. These two commandments were actually the framework for more specific norms on contracts. The third part is about particular types of contracts. So I focused then on somehow the tricky issues of the time, which were mainly the sale and loans. Sales, just price, was a big debated subject, but also the lease of the body. So, for instance, prostitution was quite a moral subject at the time. Lending and the interest prohibition is my long chapter about how was actually possible to borrow money at interest, and the strategies adopted by the Catholics and the Lutherans, and the novelties of the Reformation on this. The fourth part is about somehow the use by theological works by jurists. The point is, I not only investigated the works of theologians, but also how the jurists, the lawyers, actually used the works of the theologians. And this is the content of my fourth part, which is divided in two chapters. First chapter is about a dispute on interest, where actually theologians and jurists were cooperating in solving this dispute. And the second chapter is about the contribution of the jurists in itself. So I investigated a couple of important jurists and their opinion on issues about usury, and how this jurist actually used, or didn't use, but I saw that they used the works of the theologians. Then I have a summary, because I thought my work is too long, so I need to make a summary for people who don't have time to read, because I honestly think that nobody has time to read my entire book, is too long. But so I thought it's good to have a summary, and then conclusion. This is it.
So, yes, and I think that's a very skillful way to do it, because you can read the conclusion, and then when you find, I want to know more about this or that, I can go back and seek out exactly where you lay the argument and find the evidence and the really wonderful notes that lead you to primary sources as you go. So tell us, Luther, the Martin Luther's Reformation is a definitive turn in history, and you write that the Lutheran gaze started not from human freedom, but from the grace of God. And you emphasize the difference in justification by faith, where salvation comes through faith and not through penance. How does that affect something as worldly as contract law?
That's a wonderful question. Thank you so much. Well, the point is that somehow the entire body of rules that were created by the Lutherans, this entire body was based on the energy of faith. So the main idea was that Christians comply with rules with the energy of the Holy Spirit and their faith. So a Christian receives faith and grace, so he's saved. He has no longer to worry about eternal damnation because he's saved. And because of the faith that he received, because of the grace of God, then he is willing to follow the rules And these rules are actually followed, kept because of charity. But this charity is a fruit of gratitude for the salvation already obtained. And this is the key point of the Reformation. So Christian follows these rules because of the grace of God.
And how does that affect the law? Yes.
Yeah, I come back to it. Instead, for the Catholics, the point is different. The point is these rules are actually a road to salvation. So by complying to these rules, I either go towards salvation or towards damnation. So if I fail to keep a rule, I sin for the Catholics. I mean, I sin, and this is an obstacle to my salvation, and I have to confess this sin, and be punished for this.
May I ask for one point of clarification? Do you think this is true of Catholics today, or are you speaking about 16th century Catholics?
I am thinking about 16th century Catholics, not today.
Okay, thank you.
No. I this is just the view that was actually. I honestly must say that I didn't work with sources of the 19th, 20th, or 21st century. So this is only about 16th, 17th century. And somehow also the Lutheran positions might be completely different nowadays. I actually don't know what is the Lutheran position on contract law in the 21st century. I really don't know. But in the 16th, 17th century, there was this difference. And for the Catholics, this was, the point is that the court, so-called confession or court of conscience, had a pretty much legal character. So violation of a rule corresponded to a penance. There was a consequence. Instead, for the Lutherans, yes, there was the consequence, but the point was not about salvation, because salvation was already obtained. And this somehow affected the law in the sense that, first of all, the Catholic way of approaching to contract law was very much detailed. So the Catholics, they wrote really thousands of norms, very much detailed, because every action has to be directed, guided, and the Christian had always to know exactly what to do and not to do. If he was sinning or not sinning, that was important, that was established before. Instead, for the Lutherans, it was not always, but often a matter of principles. So you have this guideline, you have to act with charity towards your neighbor. But in the specific situation, it's just yourself. It's just you that has to decide. You have to decide what is the best way not to harm, not to damage your neighbor. So it's very much theological, less legal, and very much general. Not always, but very often. Instead, for the Catholics, we may think about restitution. It was very detailed for the Catholics, but not at all for the Lutherans. Is that clear?
Yes. So the law we have today is built on these bricks, perhaps, that are hidden from us. We stand on a giant edifice of all that came before. And you make the point in a couple of places that when religion has become marginalized in public debate, you write, and I think in the last century or a couple, the teachings of Lutheran theologians and jurists have become obsolete. Don't you think also that all that they achieved in this age has somehow underpins what we have now? And do you think that the changes of the 16th century, especially in Lutheran Northern Europe, do they still exist today? If you look at the law of, say, Denmark or Germany or the United States, would you find it informed? Since you're both a historian and a lawyer, do you find that the law we have is informed by the 16th century, and how?
That's a very good question. It's hard for me to say this, honestly, because there were so many changes afterwards. Just think about the French Revolution and so on, the Nazi period. So it's very hard for me to say that nowadays we still have something of the Lutherans or something of the Catholics and so on. I may think, but that's just a kind of hypothesis that needs to be investigated, that we still have in Europe differences between Catholics and Lutherans. And somehow these differences are still present in certain conceptions that we have. If we think about, for instance, that the conception that the Germans have about debts, there is this idea that is still very common in Germany, that people have to pay their debts. Instead, there is the American model and I would say more the Italian or Spanish model, that instead of always trying to pay debts, people can have more and more debts because the financial system needs this. Sorry. So I will think that these differences in terms of mentality might still be there in terms of mentality. But it's very hard and it will require a different project to understand whether there are connections still present now between the works of the early modern reformers and scholastics and the situation nowadays. This is just a kind of hypothesis.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I really appreciate how difficult that is. Let's look in the other direction and talk about the past. And one of the things that your book made me, who a non-specialist, wonder about is where does law come from in the first place? Since we live in this world where law is so central to public life, and imagining a system without any law would be very scary. But I suppose a fish does not know that it is wet, even though a fish probably would not like to live outside of the water. So you return in your study to the Ten Commandments, to the Decalogue, and especially 7 and 8, you shall not steal and you shall not bear false witness. And it reminded me how I read Exodus or Leviticus as a narrative, but so much of that text is rules. And is this where law comes from? Is the earliest people finding rules to govern and interpreting them as divine rules? Maybe this is what your first part, where you first begin with Catholic theologians and continue to Lutheran theologians, where they explain what they need as the divine will.
Yes, somehow the point, but tell me if I'm wrong. The point is here that there was a need of guidance. This need was first of all for the Catholics, because they had this rigid system, and that basically if you sin, you had to suffer a punishment for your sin. So there was a judge. And this judge was actually your confessor. The confessor was not simply a confessor like it is today, but he was actually a real judge. And he needed actually to know how to inflict the right punishment. So he needed somehow instruments for performing his job. But also, this is true for the penitent, because the penitent, the Christian, had to know what was right and what was wrong. And so there was a need to find some rules. And the basic idea was that the Ten Commandments include certain rules, but not only the Ten Commandments, because the idea of the Ten Commandments is very much Lutheran. For the Catholics, was not always the Decalogue, but there were also rules somehow that were created on the basis of Aristotelian philosophy and also from the canon law more in general. So not always the Decalogue. The Decalogue is mostly the Lutheran way of approaching the subject. Let's say that there were different ways, like, for instance, the virtues for the Catholics was very much important to describe sins according to the virtues, but also system based on the Decalogue as well, but on the subjects. For instance, the subject of contract and all the norms about contracts. And this was mostly a subject for theologians and canonists, but the jurists had also to say their opinion on this. Instead, for the Lutherans, it's pretty much the Decalogue. And why is this? Because, of course, for them, the scriptures were the starting point for a moral life. And so you see also here a kind of difference between the Lutherans and, for instance, for the Catholic, there is this idea of natural law as a law of nature, law of reason. And for the Lutherans, it is instead mostly charity and the precept of love for your neighbor. So the idea is that the scriptures are somehow the starting point for legal principles, but also for moral principles. Instead, for the Catholics, it's mostly an idea of guiding the Christians towards their life, but rules not necessarily have to be based on the Ten Commandments. They could also be based just on philosophy or the canon law or the virtues, but not necessarily on the Decalogue somehow. Is that okay with you? Is more clear?
What are the, when you say virtues, are we speaking about discernment and temperance and those virtues? What are these virtues?
Yes, we are talking about, for instance, the virtue of faith or the virtue of charity, but also the virtues, mainly about this virtues, but because they were important for contract. For instance, the virtue of faith was central for contracts, but mostly about these virtues. But I'm also thinking, for instance, for the Catholic, the seven capital sins, for instance, envy, and so on. So this was another way of conceptualizing somehow. So faith, charity, and hope, these virtues, but also they were taken from the Aristotelian philosophy. So, yeah.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. That explains it. Now, Martin Luther was not opposed to property, and he opposed the Peasants' Rebellion in 1524 and 25, and then Lutherans were later opposed to the utopian millenarian Anabaptist Teufelreich in Münster, which rejected the traditions of private property and also marriage. So there is a way that the Reformation conserves some of the norms and enshrines them. And can you say a bit about how they balance that? What is the appropriate way to hold property, and what is the appropriate way to you write about interest or usura? Maybe you can say how they developed those norms for the contract and the legal system.
Yes, it's a huge subject, but I try to summarize. Somehow, the basic idea of Luther was always charity, so you have not to harm your neighbor, but somehow he distinguished subjects. He distinguished between different types of Christians. There were actually the Christians who needed a loan because they were actually able to work, and so this was a necessity because they needed money. but they were actually able to work. So this type of Christians, the Christians who were actually able to work, they could be helped by a loan. And this loan needed no interest, but it was a loan. Then there were the Christians who actually needed just helps because these were not able to work, so they couldn't possibly repay a loan. So there was not, it made no sense actually to give a loan to them because there was no way that they could actually repay that loan. So they had to be helped with helps. And then there were, but this was developed by Luther's followers, there were the Christians who were actually rich. These Christians were rich, so they could actually borrow money with an interest rate because they had the money to pay the interest, simply. So there was no breaching of the law of love with this by charging an interest here because these people were rich. And so somehow they came to the conclusion that there was no need to forbid the charge of an interest towards all the people, but it was instead more appropriate to distinguish between different categories of people. The Catholics, they simply forbade charges of interest because this was prohibited by a decree of a canon law norm in the Middle Age. And this canon law norm was based on interpretation of the Cree passage of the scripture, where Christ says, land hoping for nothing in return. According to the Middle Age canonists, this was meant to say that Christ meant to say that no interest in a loan was allowed. The Lutherans instead came to say that this passage has to be interpreted in the framework of love. And if we are not damaging our neighbor, if we are practicing love towards our neighbor, and this happens for sure if our neighbor is actually rich and so he can pay the interest, then in that case, the interest can be charged. You can charge an interest towards a rich person because he has actually the money to pay the interest. It was a different approach from the scholastics. The scholastics, they just... It was once again in terms of legal reasoning. So we need a fixed rule. The rule says you can't borrow money at interest. For the Lutherans, the rule was you can actually borrow money at interest and you can actually lend your money to the neighbor and charge an interest to him. But you always have to remember the precept of love. So if the person you are actually lending your money cannot pay the interest, you have then to remit the debt. That's also a very interesting thing of the Lutherans. If your neighbor becomes poor because of a calamity or something, a pandemic like we have today, then you should remit the debt because of charity. That's the reasoning somehow of the Lutherans.
It's a middle path. It's a not to you can charge interest for the wealthy, but not the poor. And I think we have that in our bankruptcy laws, perhaps.
Perhaps, yes. We have something similar for sure. But I have to tell you that, for instance, in the past, the interest rate that they were actually able to charge in a loan was 5%. So if we think today about an interest rate of 5%, it's a dream for bankers, but maybe not for customers.
So let's talk a bit about bankers, because you make the argument that Martin Luther was opposed to the Fuggers and the Welsers, who were, perhaps supporting his mortal enemy, you know, the Emperor Charles V, but they were also draining these German cities. Correct me if I'm wrong, that all the German cities were floundering economically, except for Hamburg, which of course has a Hanseatic connection and all the Baltic Sea trade. Can you describe the early 16th century fiscal situation for a German city? They seem to me such wealthy commercial places, you know, in the memory of time, these German merchants, you know, but what was the economics? What was the banking? And what did Luther think?
Okay, so the situation in Germany was very different from the cities and the countryside, because for the great part, the German economy was actually based on the land. So when we think about bankers, we have to think about Augsburg, or we have to think about Rostock, or commercial cities somehow. Instead, the reality in the countryside, for instance, Wittenberg, where Luther lived, it was mainly an economy centered on the land. But that doesn't mean necessarily that commerce, trade was actually not important. It was important anyway, but certainly it was mostly practiced in the big cities, in the great cities. For instance, we see in Rostock, there is actually a theologian who is actually both. One is Johannes Aepinus, the other one is Paul van Hansen. Heidsen, actually, von Hansen, but Johannes Aepinus. And both of them, they actually dealt with contract law issues. And I'm not sure, but I'm almost sure that they decided to write sermons on this because the economy in Rostock required such a kind of theological advice. Instead, for Luther, I don't think he actually had somehow... Wittenberg wasn't a city of bankers. It was not like Augsburg, so or Rostock, for instance. So he had experience with that for sure, but not something that he had in daily life somehow. But he had to guide the Reformation somehow and discuss also these issues. And there were a lot of disputes with Johannes Heck, who was actually a Catholic theologian. And he tried somehow to defend a financial operation called the 5% contract of Wiederkaufliche Zins. To explain this is quite complex, but I just say to you and to the people who are actually listening to us that this is a contract created in fraud of the usury prohibition. Somehow, as the Catholics said, that loans at interest were forbidden. You couldn't charge a loan, charge interest to people in a loan, then they devised a sale. So they created something very similar with centered on the land, on the fruits of the land, and it was called a sale. As it was a sale, but the effect was basically the same, then it could be practiced. And Luther refused this because Luther basically said, no, it doesn't matter if it is a sale or it's a loan. If you charge interest, this is something that is completely wrong anyway. And this idea that we have to distinguish between people and if charity is actually not offended is something that was developed by Luther's followers. So Luther himself was actually against the charge of interest. But his followers, and then it's very interesting because we see a change, Luther's followers somehow changed this view. Started from Luther, but changed this view and finished, ended up allowing the charge of interest in a loan. And then at the moment, it didn't matter anymore. At the moment, it didn't matter anymore if it was a sale or a loan. It was just a matter of breaching charity or not breaching charity. That was the point for the Lutherans. But Luther himself, at the beginning, he was completely against the charge of interest. Is that clear?
Yes, yes. And I also think we can see the trajectory of his thinking, because he began the whole Reformation, at least this is the way we learn this when we're very young, is in opposition to the idea that you would transact money for an indulgence, this penance, and that German pennies were flying down to Rome to build palaces for the clergy, right? That you cannot exchange money for spiritual matters. And is there a connection there, or am I oversimplifying?
Actually, on this, I didn't find a connection. That yes, that could be, of course, but not something in specific that I worked with about this. A connection that is actually that somehow the church was actually using these contracts, this Wiederkaufliche Zins, or census, the church bishops and church institutions were actually using these contracts to get their money. In this sense, yes, there is a connection. So not so much about the indulgences, but mostly about, I would say, the using of this specific contract that Luther condemned by the church. And Luther said the church shouldn't use this contract.
Okay, so from that position to the idea that there is an appropriate interest, no more than 5% for the wealthy and charity for the poor.
Yeah.
You write that. So another very simple view we have of Luther is from Max Weber, that the Protestant work ethic leads to the spirit of capitalism. Do you think that is incorrect?
Okay, Max Weber is such a great subject, because when I was writing actually my PhD, I had to discuss Weber, of course. But you will find that there are tons of books about Weber, and people said exactly the opposite thing of what Weber said, or simply he said that he was right. In my view, somehow Weber wasn't right, actually. It was right somehow to stress the fact that there is a connection between economy and theology. That, I think, is right. But I don't think, and this is what most, good economists said, that somehow the theory of Max Weber is actually wrong, and de facto it didn't work. But that there was actually a connection between theology and law, and theology and economics, yes, I think this is pretty much true. And in my book, I tried to show that somehow it was probably actually the opposite. So somehow the Lutherans were even more strict. They were even stricter than the Catholics, because the Catholics, with this general prohibition, they simply forbade charges of interest. But for the Lutherans, the conscience was so much important. And then the Lutherans, then they had somehow always to consider if they are damaging or not damaging the neighbors. The Catholics, I didn't say this rightly, but the Catholics basically, they forbade interest on loans, but then they allowed all these contracts that were somehow sales. They classified these canons or other contracts like this that were classified as sales, but somehow they were then widely practiced by merchants. Instead, for the Lutherans, it was more kind of personal decision, of course, guided by the scriptures, guided by priests, but a kind of a personal decision instead of a general prohibition. And then everybody can do whatever he wants as soon as he uses a sale instead of a loan.
That's very interesting. And I think it's a Catholic as a Catholic, I think we can make the joke that there is a tendency to make rules and then ignore them. But I think that's a simplification and a joke. But I can see how Luther developed that. Would you say a little bit more about the different rules that came out of this? For example, you said something about did you say property and prostitution or privacy and prostitution? How was that in early modern Germany interpreted between the Lutherans and the Catholics?
Yes. Okay. So, first of all, let me say that I'm also Catholic, but for me it was some fun, so much interesting to study a different perspective to what I was somehow my tradition. So to study the Lutheran tradition was very, very much interesting for me, even though I am and I remain a Catholic myself. But so coming to property or sale, I think if we look at sale, for instance, is very much interesting. For the Catholics and for the Lutherans, there was always the need of a just price. What is the just price? Simply, you can't sell goods at the value that you think is they are worth. This is something that we have now, but in the past it wasn't like this. In the past, you always had to keep equality. What is equality? Equality means that it's a kind of legacy of Aristotle. Commutative justice means that everybody has to get the same benefits from a certain transaction. So none of the parties has to gain more and the other less. If I sell something that doesn't have the just price, so the market price, the just price was actually the market price, then I'm actually defrauding my neighbor because I'm getting more actually than the value, the real value of the specific good. So if a house, the market price of a house is, let's say, $3,000, but I sell the house at $500, then I'm defrauding my neighbor. So there was this idea that the Christians who sell a good for a price that is actually higher than the market price are defrauding their neighbors. For the Catholics, if there was such a kind of violation, they had an entire body of rules how to make restitution. What is restitution? Well, nowadays, if you commit a sin, you just go to your priest, you confess it, you have your penance, your punishment for this, and that's it. But in the early modern period, in the Middle Age, you have to make restitution. So you had actually to return to your neighbor that you defrauded, the money that you actually have defrauded. So if I sold my house at $500 and the market price was actually $300, there are these $200 that I defrauded my neighbor, and I had to return this to my neighbor. And this for the Catholic was a requirement for salvation. If I didn't return my money, this $200 that I defrauded to my neighbor, then I will actually not be saved. And the same was true for the Lutherans, but in a different sense. It was not a matter of salvation, because salvation is something you already got. But it was a matter of somehow gratitude for God for the salvation that I already obtained. Then I don't have to sin anymore. And so if I discover that I am in a state of sin, so I'm actually sinning, then I have to return this to my neighbor. But for the Catholics, as this was a matter of crucial matter of salvation, so they dictated a body of rules, very specific, for instance, what to do if my neighbor is dead, what to do if I don't have any more of the money, what I have to do. The Lutherans, there was just a general principle. You have just to return your money and that's it. But they didn't specify all the rules in detail. Instead, for the Catholics, this was so important that they actually to establish fixed rules. And then we have this treatises dedicated to restitution, the restituzione, and so something like 1,000 pages how to make restitution. The Lutherans, let's say 20 pages, and that's it. You have to make restitution. How you make it is your problem somehow. This was, it's general, it's very general in very general terms, but they were not so detailed as the Catholics on this.
Thank you. Well, I think there's more to say, but we have to leave it there. And I just want to say again that as you observed, your conclusion by itself is a brilliant essay. But then the book as a whole is filled with a lucid and extremely specific discussion that sets it up. So it's quite a magisterial accomplishment, and it was a great pleasure to read. So Dr. Paolo Astori, thank you very much for being part of the New Books in History podcast.
Thank you so much. It was a great pleasure for me. And thank you for this interview.
Thank you.